This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, Bosnia's civil war and how it ravaged one Muslim family, the Celics. Our guest is Chuck Sudetic. He is Croatian-American. His wife is a Serb who is related by marriage to the Celics. Sudetic covered the collapse of Yugoslavia and the war in Bosnia from 1990 to 1995 for the New York Times. He is the author of Blood and Vengeance, One Family's Story of the War in Bosnia. In the field covering the war, Sudetic found himself addicted to the story yet disengaged. He writes in the book's prologue of the Times' bifurcated coverage, one focus, the players, people and institutions and their actions, the second focus, the common folk and the horror of war, head and heart separate. But by the end of his war correspondence, he was faltering in his ability to walk the two paths simultaneously. He was, to use his word, wobbling. In the winter of 1995, Sudetic, his wife and young daughter, moved from Belgrade to New York. But in the fall of 1995, the journalist returned to Bosnia to meet the Celics who had survived the Serbian slaughter at the alleged UN safe area, Srebrenica. During the summer of 1995, thousands of Muslims were killed at the hands of the Serbs in Srebrenica. As we talk, I encourage you to join us with your questions in Champaign-Urbana. The phone number is 333-9455. Outside Champaign, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Chuck Sudetic, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure to be here.
In my introduction, I focused on your comments in the prologue of Blood and Vengeance and the two tracks that your stories for the New York Times could take. What's your feeling about that two-track philosophy, and has it changed over time?
Well, it hasn't changed very much over time, because you have to understand that when you're writing things as a journalist, you have to tailor them to the outlet that you're speaking through. If I'm going to speak to you over the radio, I'm going to speak in one way. If I'm going to present information to people through the pages of the New York Times, I'm going to present it in a completely different way. And so they're perfectly legitimate different treatments of the same factual material. The reason that I refer to that in the book is that in my 5 years of covering Yugoslavia for the Times, I found that the stories generally dealt with the events on the ground as they would echo in the halls of government in Washington or in the different capitals of the world. It was the horrors of Bosnia and what duty was owed to the Bosnians by the people on the outside, the governments on the outside. And those were the main theme. That was the main flow of the treatment. And what I found was that I always felt as if my stories fell short in capturing the deep structure that was Bosnia, the social undercurrents, the passions that exploded there and existed within that country and within that community before and during the war. And I came upon the story of the Celics and saw that in the tiny anecdotal stories that they told me about life in their peasant village, I could capture that deep structure, and I could use it to illustrate and explain the events, the horrible violence that took place during the war.
Mm. One starting point in the story you tell in Blood and Vengeance is the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. The Ottoman Turks conquer what is now Serbia. Muslim landowners rule over Christian serfs. And then, as the story continues much later, in World War II, Croats and some Muslims join with the Nazis, and we have another horrific massacre. And all this history brings us to the nationalism of Serbia today. But why is it and how is it that the memories in this part of the world seem to have such a long, long lifetime?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the memories are horrible.
Right.
The memories cannot be forgotten, no more than the memories of the Holocaust could be forgotten by Jews in the present day. It's something that lives in your psyche from the forevermore. And the fact of the matter is that within Bosnia, you had groups, Muslims and Serbs, or I focus on them primarily in my book, so I'm going to keep my my comments to them. Within both of those groups, you have memories of violent acts that were carried out by members of the other group that cannot be denied and cannot be reconciled, or were not given the opportunity to be reconciled, most specifically in the period after World War II. These, yes, the nations of Bosnia, the Muslims and the Serbs, most clearly got along well for 45 years after World War II, but the memories remained. They would not have exploded in violence if it hadn't been for a cynical manipulation of these memories by the president of Serbia, Slobodan Milosevic, in his efforts to keep himself in political power in Serbia and in Belgrade, in what is now the new rump Yugoslavia, and used by him almost as a hypnotist, uses a watch to befuddle the Serbian nation and to get him to do get them to do his bidding.
Hmm. You know, thinking back to the Battle of Kosovo in 1389, and now today's headlines we're reading about Kosovo in 1998. Serbs think of Kosovo as their historic heartland because of the Battle of Kosovo in 1389.
Yeah. The thing is, Celeste, that Kosovo is more important for the myth of the battle than it ever was for the reality. The myth of the battle that was nurtured in the years that the Serbs suffered under the Ottoman Empire, specifically the last years of the empire, when the empire was imploding. It was there. The empire became essentially a lawless state in which the powerful local men could do what they wanted with the weak local peasantry. That this myth became a rallying cry for the creation of a Serbian state, an uprising against a repressive regime by any standard, and then for the expansion of that state and the elimination of the Muslims, Slavs, just like the Serbs, within that state. That's the power of the myth of Kosovo, and that cannot be denied in the psyche of the Serbian nation. I've never met a Serb who wasn't passionate about it. It's one of the most intriguing phenomena that I've ever imagined. The myth of the Civil War in the American South is of a similar nature, but much less intense than the myth of Kosovo to the Serbs. And today we see that same yearning to protect Kosovo for the Serbian state being played out in the battlefields of Kosovo against the local majority Albanian population.
Mm. What is the role Milosevic is playing today in Kosovo?
Well, the Kosovo issue for Milosevic is an issue of great cynicism. He is interested primarily in maintaining political power. He is using the violence in Kosovo as a means of deflecting attention within the Serbian nation from the economic breakdown, his own plundering of the economy, the destruction of the political opposition, the destruction of the independence of the independence of the media, the destruction of the what's left of the independence of the judiciary, and even now in the last few weeks, the destruction of the independence of Belgrade University. And these are things that are tearing away at the connective tissue of the Serbian nation, all for the sake of maintaining his political power. I don't want to sound like an apologist for the Albanians, because I'm not. In my opinion, personal opinion, Serbia is a de jure part Kosovo is a de jure part of the Serbian state. This is something that, despite all the repression of the Albanian population in Kosovo, is a fact of life. And the Kosovo Albanians were the ones who took up arms to fight back, albeit, once again to stress, that they were under tremendous repression and didn't receive the international attention that they should have received for the 10 years that they suffered in what was basically an apartheid state. They went picking the fight. Milosevic was only too happy to engage when he felt it to his political advantage. And I think that what we see being played out there is going to be a long-term conflict that is much to his interest to continue, despite the fact that it endangers the security of all of southeastern Europe.
Hmm. So you think that there is a great possibility for the conflict widening?
Yes, sure. If you looked at the pages of the Washington Post today, you see once again we have shooting back and forth across the border between Serbia and Albania. There's the possibility of large numbers of ethnic Albanian troops being forced from Kosovo back into Albania, which is not going to be a happy situation for the Albanian state because it is a weak state. It's a weak government that could be overthrown by a militant minority within the Albanian community that could come from Kosovo and galvanize, you know, some type of civil unrest there, and then spill back across the border from Albania into the neighboring state of Macedonia, where there's a rest of Albanian minority as well. This is something that, as I said before, threatens all of southeastern Europe. Slobodan Milosevic would be only too happy to see this kind of unrest because, as I said, it deflects attention away from him and lets him get on with the business of running his fiefdom.
Given that the role the UN and NATO played in Bosnia was troubled, the UN and NATO really fell down over and over again. What's ahead for Kosovo?
I think that what's ahead is more of the same. I think that I worked as a political analyst in Belgrade for the last 6 months covering the Milosevic regime for a group called the International Crisis Group, which is a political advocacy organization that follows crisis situations around the world. And what's absolutely clear is that there is no international will to administer the medicine necessary to bring peace back to the region. And what that means is to put pressure on Milosevic to stop this insane violence that he is only nurturing. I mean, clearly, we have treated Milosevic with kid gloves. There's a fire there, and instead of calling in the fireman, we have called the arsonist who started the fires burning in the first place. The American policy towards Yugoslavia has been to treat Milosevic as if we had some kind of special persuasive powers that could get him to do our bidding. And frankly, this is a kind of obscene self-delusion. The fact is, we should stop talking with this man. We should expedite war crimes actions against him. We should do what we can to get money into the hands of the legitimate political opposition in Serbia, which is so poverty-stricken right now that they can barely afford to pay their phone bills. And we should contact directly through our diplomats in Belgrade the military chiefs and the chiefs of the secret police and tell them that we are no longer going to deal with Milosevic and that, as far as we're concerned, his days are numbered. If we took that kind of a strict stand against this man, I think that you would see that he would make peace with the Kosovo Albanians very, very quickly, and that Kosovo in the long term would remain within the Serbian state. The way things are going, we're pushing toward a partition of that state by military means, which is something that the entire world has tried, that the diplomats of the world have tried to avoid ever since the dark days of World War II. It's been enshrined in our policy that we will not recognize the changing of borders anywhere in the world by violence. And that's the situation we are in a luck to be grinding toward.
Hmm. When you left in Europe in January of 1995, you promised you'd never return to Bosnia. But when you started work in New York, you knew leaving Bosnia had been a mistake. What was going on in your mind at that time, and how did you know that you had taken a wrong turn?
I knew that the minute I landed in New York and went into the office. I knew that I was in a place where I felt I didn't belong. I remember feeling, when you're in a war situation, the adrenaline rush is something that I think only a heroin addict might understand. It's extremely exciting. And leaving it is like being ripped away from the thing that you love most in life. And this is not something I'm proud of, because it meant, for me, essentially turning my back on my wife and my kids to go off in this quixotic adventure for 2 months at a time and come back home. And, you know, I would go off for 2 months and come back for 2 weeks. And my behavior during that 2 weeks was one of always nervous anxiety. I was not a pleasant person to be around. Only when I got back to Bosnia was life simple. Did life have a kind of meaning that was missing when I was at home? And as I said, when I came back, when I made the break, when I tried to get out of Bosnia, and I was pretty exhausted by that time,
mm-hmm.
95. This was after 4 years of cover and war. When I made the break and came back to the state, it was like going into a decompression chamber. And I longed to get back. And in, as I said, I have a relationship with the main characters of mm-hmm. my book, the family of my brother-in-law's, my brother-in-law, the woman who's, I call him my brother-in-law because in Yugoslavian, Yugoslavian kinship relations, this thing does exist, that there's no similar word for it in English. I knew that I had left them behind. They were in the little town of Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia, essentially captured and inside a concentration camp protected by the United Nations. When the United Nations reneged on its promise to protect these people in July 1995, and I knew what was going to happen. I mean, it was clear that there was a blood vengeance vendetta by the Serbs against the Muslims of that town. I knew there was going to be horrible violence. And when I saw that happen, that's when the dam broke. And I said to myself, look, I'm going back whatever way I can, because I have to get back in the ball game. And the result of that was the book that I wrote.
Hmm. When did you first meet Huso?
I met Huso in 1992, a few weeks before the war began. I went to Sarajevo with my brother-in-law, the Muslim who was married to my wife's sister. He was going down to vote in a referendum on Bosnia's independence, and we went to see his father. His father's a very normal blue-collar kind of guy who worked in the brickyard of a construction company, and that's where I met him. We talked for about 2 hours there. And he fell victim to a heart attack a few days later and went back to his home village in eastern Bosnia to recuperate. And that's where the war caught him. I never met the man again. I talked with him once by mm-hmm. ham radio when Srebrenica was surrounded. And that was the only contact I had with him. And essentially, the reconstruction of his life in the book is based upon those two small conversations and hundreds of other conversations that I had with members of the family, with both the Muslim and the Serb neighbors, and also in the broader context with the Serbs who were living around the town of Srebrenica and who suffered greatly at the hands of the Muslims who were within that town.
When did the family move from their homestead to Srebrenica?
They were driven out in April or May, April and May, actually. They left twice, and once and went back, and then were driven out again, of 1992, and they ended up in Srebrenica in September of 1992 and lived there until the town fell to the Serbs in 1995. And getting back to what I was saying before, the thing that I'm most proud of in the book is, I think Blood and Vengeance does that other books haven't done, is to to present these people as they really are. The people of eastern Bosnia, the Muslim and Serb peasant population, are a culture that's very, very different from the culture of modern-day urban society, modern-day America. These are people who, I can give you an example. I mean, just a generation ago, when the communists forbid the Muslim women from wearing the veil and made them take it off, I know the story of one Muslim woman from a village right next to where my brother-in-law was born, who was taken to a police station and put into custody. And this was not, you know, they weren't taken out and beaten and held for days and days without water and food. And this wasn't the kind of thing. They were just held to cool off for a day in a room. And it was the first time in her life she had ever seen an electric light bulb. This was just like about 1950. And the story that the Muslim women tell is that they were gathered around in this room, and they saw this woman climb up onto a chair and attempt to blow the light bulb out, because the only other light she had known was candles and oil lamps. She didn't have a concept. This gives you an idea of how backward this part of the world is. It's the story that I wrote is a story of hexes and dervishes and mystics, and a story about an elaborate cult of the dead that that the Serbs up in that part of the world retain to this day, a cult where they believe that the dead walk among them and have to be appeased, and if they're not, then they can cause them great damage. In fact, the etymology of the word vampire comes from the Slavic word, a Slavic word from the South Slavs. It's an extraordinary story of how people were motivated in the way they were, how their fears led to their fears led them to hatred, and their hatred led them to violence. And it's, as I said, I think that the anecdotes of the story really capture this in a way that I have never seen done before.
There's a story that you tell about how the mountain was, Star Mountain is the English translation.
Right.
We'll let you handle the
Slavic.
But the creation of this mountain was formed by water, and the creator of this mountain is...
Yes, the creator of the mountain was a mythological... In the myth, what we're talking about is a myth, a story, based probably on a historic figure who was the wife of actually a Serbian feudal ruler in that part of the country during the Middle Ages. But the thing that's most telling about the myth of how the mountain was created is the fact that within the myth, it carries a story about the destruction to come. This was not, it was a very beautiful place to live, but it was not a comfortable place to live. This was a place that had known violence, and it was a place where life was very, very difficult. And the story goes, it was a border area. It was a border area for many years. And the story goes that the mythological female figure, this heroine, who created the mountain, actually created it as the wall of a fortress. And she formed a body, a group of soldiers from water, and they built up the stone to create this wall that served as a fortress. And it's, as I said, the second part of the story is that she left signs in the living rock of the wall, the signs that I've seen with my own eyes. And the story of the signs, these are figures of soldiers on horses, very, very crude figures of soldiers on horses and eagles, and beneath them there is a hole, like a cave, that's covered with small rock. And the story goes that when someone comes and deciphers these cryptic signs, that the entire that water will burst forth from this hole in the wall of the mountain and wash the land away. And as I said, you examine this and you think about it, and you see that people realize that they felt the seeds of the destruction very, very intimately, And I think that this is clearly a figurative way of expressing the kind of insecurity mm-hmm. that people who live in a troubled border area feel. This is something that's very difficult for Americans to understand. I think the only analogy that I can think of that comes to mind that Americans might be able to catch on to would be the analogy of a suburban population that finds itself with a neighborhood that's changing racially. And they begin to wonder about their property values, and they begin to feel insecure because, let's say, a black family has moved into the neighborhood. It's that kind of underlying fear that is similar to what you experience up there. But the intensity of that fear on this mountain in Bosnia was exacerbated by the fact that in generations past, genocidal killings, massacres were carried out by the people who were your neighbors. The Serbs knew the Muslims who had killed and drawn blood in the past, and the Muslims knew the neighbors, the names, the faces of the Serbs who had drawn blood in the past. And this kind of underlying tension, this fault line running underneath this community, was the thing that buckled in 1992, when Milosevic, as I said, used his powers to create this explosion of passion that was the Bosnian War.
Mm. The safe areas, were they doomed from the outset?
No, they weren't doomed from the outset. It was a bad idea that could have turned into a good idea if the members. Nations of the United Nations Security Council had seen fit to keep the promise that they had given to the Muslims they were supposed to be protecting. What they did was declare a safe area and then not give the United Nations troops on the grounds the means to make the areas really safe. They promised they promised airstrikes against the Serbs if they attacked the safe areas, and eventually they reneged on the promise. And what happened in Srebrenica is a perfect example of the abominable violence that followed, that came with the handing over of the safe area by the United Nations to the Serbs. And the fault of the United Nations lies, yes, in the fact that they... It lies primarily with the member governments of the Security Council, specifically Washington, London, Paris, Moscow, because they passed a resolution and they ignored the promise that they had given by not giving the men, the soldiers of the United Nations Protection Force on the ground in Bosnia, the means to make the area safe. That said, however, the commander of the UN force, General Jean-Pierre, and the political leader of the United Nations force, Yasushi Akashi, did not call in the airstrikes at the time that they were most needed. And the thing that they're at fault for was ignoring the fact that anyone who knew anything about Bosnia knew that the Serbs around Srebrenica had a vendetta against the Muslims inside. And this was the result of the military actions by the people from Srebrenica, the Muslims, from inside out in the period of the early spring of 1992 to the early winter of 1993. Essentially, the Muslims fought a food war. They were 40,000 strong and left by the Serbs to starve, and left unwisely by the Serbs to starve. And what they did, naturally enough, was to take up whatever arms they could and push outward, taking over as much food and larder and plundering as many larders as they could along the way. This led to great, great suffering by the local Serbian population, and that was the antecedent to the blood vengeance vendetta that was carried out in 1995 in July.
Mm. And the Serbians, with realizing that they weren't going to be hit with airstrikes, saw that they had sheep in sheep's clothing.
Exactly. They knew... they essentially thumbed their nose at the world and killed between 7,000 and 8,000 people, predominantly men, well over 90% men, mostly men of military age. But there were some women and children who fell as well, not so much in executions, but in military skirmishes. The vast majority of those men were killed in executions. Mm-hmm. That's clear. And as I said, the what I tried to do in Blood and Vengeance was to go and talk to the Serbs of that area, to learn their past, to learn the antecedents to the ill will that existed between the Muslims and the Serbs of that region, and to try to draw a picture. The book is not an analysis by any stretch of the imagination. It reads like a novel. It tells stories. And through these stories, I wanted to draw a picture that would explain why it was that this horrible thing could happen. It's not a justification for what happened. It's to explain why it happened and what were the consequences of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think with Blood and Vengeance, it's possible for us to get a better understanding of what happened and why it happened. Because in news accounts, it lacks that narrative where it all comes together. Do you know what I'm
getting at? Yeah, I understand. And this is what I was alluding to at the top of the show, where I felt exactly the same thing. I've been studying Yugoslavia for 15 years, and I've read a lot of histories and a lot of political analyses of Yugoslavia over those years, and believe me, they're incredibly boring, and they never seem to capture discuss the situation of the common man out in the field. And as I said, that the passions that existed within the peasant society, the lumpen society of Eastern Bosnia, were the fuel that exploded in 1992, at the beginning of the war. And as I said, I thought that if I was able to collect enough anecdotes and present them in a really honest and balanced way, that I could explain, even for readers who would never take an interest in Yugoslavia, how it was that this horrible violence actually happened. And I think that in the end of the day, what I stumbled into was an explanation of how people can be, in general, anywhere, can be forced or drawn by circumstances and emotions out of control, emotions that have run rampant, to carry out horrible acts of violence against people with whom they had very intimate relations for a long period of time. It is a story of Bosnia. It is a story of Yugoslavia, but it's a story about us. It's about what is within us, both the evil and the humor and the good. All dimensions, from the man who works with a hoe to the man who is a general at the command of an army. That's the multidimensional aspect of the war that I tried to capture.
Mm-hmm. What has happened to the Celik family?
Well, the family went through a breakdown during the war in Srebrenica because it was a prison mentality, and in many cases, and if you're a journalist, you can only present small snippets of actual life, and what happens almost ineluctably is when you see only small snippets, your mind fills in the blanks. And it tends to give people the benefit of the doubt, and you end up creating an image, inferring an image that is essentially romantic. And another thing, what I tried to show was how these people actually reacted to one another, and what it was anything but romantic. It was people who were at each other's throats, mm-hmm. people who were under great stress, family arguments over small things. Eventually, one of the young daughter, the sister of my brother-in-law, left the family and got married. if there was any, if there's anything romantic in this book, it's the story of her, her courtship with a young man in Srebrenica, and the fact that she chose to get married almost within a prison to another prisoner, and chose to conceive a child under those circumstances because she wanted to have something to live for. Because the uncertainty of life in that captive society was so great that you hunger to find something of meaning in your life. And for her, it was to give birth, with tragic consequences, because on the day that the baby was born, on July 15th, 1995, in all likelihood, that baby lost its father, both grandfathers, and an uncle, all in executions.
And her name is Sanella.
Sanella, yeah.
And she married Muhammad.
Muhammad Halilovich, yes. Mm-hmm. She lives in Toronto now. I used the money from the... I wrote a story about them for the Rolling Stone in 1995. And I used the money of my that I got for the piece. I gave it away. I mean, it was, you don't write stories like this about your family. Keep the money. And, she's used it to help herself get a immigrant visa to Canada and to come to the new world and to begin a new life as a single mother in a modern urban area. And for a peasant girl from Bosnia who believes in hexes and mystics, this is a huge step.
Have you talked with her about how she will talk with her child about what happened?
The idea of the stories of the horrors of the past being passed down to subsequent generations is one of the mechanisms that lies at the heart of the story of my book, because it's a very dangerous exercise. And her baby is still small. The boy is just a month over 3 years old now, and he's just starting to speak. And he speaks excellent English, by the way. It's a very, very difficult thing, because so often the hatred that can be engendered by the stories of the horrors that went on in the past is worse than the ill feeling, the ill will that people who have actually experienced it has. Vicarious experiences, in many ways, are stronger experiences than the actual experience. If you survive a shooting, you have a much more reasonable view of that than you do than is if you hear about a shooting in which your father was killed. And, you know, it's one of the things that I hope she's able to communicate to her son, is that the fact that, yes, this horrible thing happened to her and to him, in the fact that they lost so many members of their families, but also to remember that their relatives are Serbs. That baby's mm-hmm. first cousins are Serbs. My children are half Serb and half Croat Irish American. And their first cousins are Muslim Serbs. To understand that the ties that bind us are much closer than the hatreds and the memories that would divide us. This is something you can only hope will, my hope is that the kid will grow up to be a perfectly good Canadian and play hockey and say A from time to time in his accent and not think very much about Bosnia and consider it a thing of the past. If there's something I could do for my family in writing this book, it's an attempt to, as accurately as possible, explain what happened to show that there's no reason to go back, because the people that I'm related to have been lucky. Most of them have gotten out. This is something that's, you know, the reality, the burden of the war for the people, especially the thousands of single mothers who were left without their husbands after Srebrenica, is just an incredible there's an incredible trauma that they experienced and an incredible burden that they have been forced to bear, and not one that the international community has sought very with very much effort to help. The women of Srebrenica, I was in Sarajevo over the summer, and the women of Srebrenica were demonstrating because they had gotten no help and they had gotten no answers about the whereabouts of their fallen husbands.
And Sinella, does she... You talk about her in the epilogue, kind of, I get the sense that she knows, but she doesn't want to know, or she doesn't want to admit, because...
Admitting means to lose hope.
Mm-hmm.
And hope for a young girl with a baby is something that you want to cling to because the reality is too difficult to imagine. And as I in the book, I describe how she goes to a Muslim mystic, and through numerology, birth dates and secret mystical numbers, he tells her that her husband is still alive. She went to another mystic woman, and she told her that her husband was alive with two other men on a place surrounded by water, and that in a number of years a woman would come and tell her of him. And these things engendered, they nurtured this forlorn hope that he would come back miraculously. As I said, I think now that she's been in Canada and she's put some distance between herself and Bosnia itself and the time, both in time and space, between herself and the event, she's come to grips with the fact that her husband is gone forever and that she has to pull herself together. But this is a woman who suffered a tremendous trauma, and that is not something that goes away, you know, lightly. This is something that she cries about.
Mm-hmm. Her capacity for hope, though, is remarkable.
Her capacity for hope is remarkable, but the fact that it's also a capacity for denial, because the hope comes in the denial. Not in a reasonable, a reasonable assessment of what she knows to be true. And one of the things I did in the book was to try, in doing the book, was, and I write about it in the book, is to I went back up on the mountain where her husband was last seen, and this is a mountain that is covered with the skeletal remains of Muslims who died in ambushes. And by suicide, and by friendly fire. Men who hallucinated and shot at fellow Muslims thinking that they were the enemy, the Serbs. And I went looking for his shirt among these remains, the pants that I knew he was wearing, the leather jacket that I knew he was wearing, and I looked through pockets among these remains, looking for the picture that he carried of her with him when he left Srebrenica on July 11th, 1995. But I never found it. If I had been lucky enough to find it, then you have something to carry back, and you can put closure on this event and move on. But it's the not knowing, the fact that you can never put closure on the event, which it creates a long-term torment.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, listen, Celeste, thank you very much for the opportunity. It was my pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you again.
Chuck Sudetic has been our guest. Look for his book, Blood and Vengeance, One Family's Story of the War in Bosnia. The publisher is Norton.